You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When people want to check the morning headlines, more and more of them are opening their computers rather than a newspaper. So how do the online versions compare with the print versions, and how are they put together? Well, joining me now are WashingtonPost.com's executive editor Jim Brady and Rich Meislin, associate managing editor for Internet at The New York Times, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
So do the same items appear on the front pages of the website and the print versions of the paper? Let's begin with you, Jim, the Washington Post.
Certainly a lot of the time they do, but not always. Obviously, the paper has a finite deadline when it's published, and a lot happens in the hours right after that deadline. So we're often looking forward, talking about what's happened since the paper's been published, what's going to happen in the subsequent few hours. So obviously, if the Post has a strong enterprise piece or a scoop of any kind, we're likely to have that on the page all day long, but we're not similar on a 24/7 basis.
And you have editorial meetings like the print version?
Yes.
The same at the Times?
Pretty much the same. We actually sometimes go out of our way to take a different angle on the story in the morning once the printed newspaper has come out, so that people who read both get a different take on the news when they get to the website.
And is that your sense, that people will read the newspaper and then go to the website, read the same story?
Not read the same story, but they look for supplemental information and they look for the other things that we offer that aren't offered or can't be offered in the printed paper, like video or more interactivity, more interaction with our staff.
Am I likely to get more pictures of an event in the on the web version, Jim?
That depends on the event. I mean, obviously, there are certain events that are great for photography, and there are others that are not, but certainly for any major news event, we're likely to do photo galleries and video pieces as well, and we try pretty aggressively to drive people from the paper to the site for that kind of content.
Have the demands of the website changed the writing process for reporters in general?
Well, I don't think there's much doubt about that. I think, we've had something called the continuous news desk in the Washington Post newsroom for the last 4 years or so, and staffed by reporters whose job it is to, crank out stories over the course of the day, often, five or six takes over the course of a day. So I think it's certainly changed in that reporters are certainly putting their, putting the structure of their story together much earlier in the day than I think they did in the previous environment. And I think the writing style changes with that. But we've had a fair amount of feedback from the Post newsroom that suggests, boy, having a structure the story at 1 in the afternoon versus 6 or 6:30 in the afternoon actually helps at the end of the day.
But we also find we're structured very much the same way. We also find that sometimes you'll put something up on the web and other sources will come forward to help change the angle of the story by the time it gets into the printed newspaper. We also do a lot of work with our, particularly with our foreign staff, which is on different time zones, and they'll file early for the website and then turn around the story for the printed newspaper. So we're working much more towards a 24-hour schedule.
And that's something that people were concerned about in the past, that newspapers were published once a day or a number of editions, but they couldn't really respond well to the 24-hour news cycle. And now that's not a problem? Or is this something that's in transition?
Well, it's in transition, and I think there's a different problem, which is when you force reporters to get their materials together and write earlier in the day, you sometimes lose some of the time they'd otherwise have to contemplate what they're writing about. So sometimes somebody will do a story and then they'll have time to think about it. And the final story that you see in the newspaper will reflect the extra thought.
You sound like you're in agreement, Jim.
Yeah, there's no question that there's a real challenge for reporters these days, and that, in our case, we launched as a joint partnership with Bonneville, Washington Post Radio, down here 2 months ago. And so in addition to reporters often having to file earlier for the web, they're also often having to go onto the radio to talk about their story, potentially sitting down in the, in the TV studio the Post has to do a shot for, a cable network, and maybe even coming on the website to do a, 1 hour live discussion with readers. So certainly the number of different media types that reporters are being asked to serve is increasing, and there's no question there's a pressure on the reporting time.
And the Times is also increasingly having reporters do video features. It sounds to me like they're working a lot harder than they used to.
Well,
less time to party.
Well, they certainly are working hard. We've done some experimenting with swapping off people's duties in order to give them more time to do things for the web. For example, Frank Bruni has started a blog on nytimes.com, and he no longer does the same type of Diner's Journal that he did in the Friday paper. What we're trying to do is to keep the demands of what we're asking within the bounds of reasonableness for the people who are trying to do some new things for us.
My guests are Rich Meiselin, Associate Managing Editor for Internet at the New York Times, and Jim Brady, Executive Editor at WashingtonPost.com. We're talking about the changes in the newspaper business. Some people suggest to a point where computers will be the way people read newspapers in the future. Right now, there are a lot of people who might resent the fact that they can't get Frank Bruni's Diner's Journal anymore in the newspaper, that they have to go to the computer. Not everybody likes doing that sort of thing.
Well, these are trade-offs that we're making in order to continue to get the quality of the staff of the New York Times before both audiences. The overlap between the two isn't all that large, and so what we've done is expanded our audience quite considerably through our online presence, and there are certain different things that are desired or required online that we also have to accommodate.
What kind of traffic do you get on the websites? After all, the Washington Post is largely a local paper. The website is a way of presenting a national face, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah, we, you know, Nielsen had us at 9.1 million uniques in March, and I think we realize that, you know, we're in a slightly different situation than the Times in that we don't have a national, you know, footprint on the print side. So
what does 9 million uniques mean?
It means 9.1 million people in the United States accessed the site in the month of March.
And do you have any sense of how many of them are local, the people who normally would have read the Post, and how many of them are people who would like to have read the Post but didn't have it available?
About 85% of those uniques are from outside the Washington area. So for us, you know, it's a huge opportunity for us to reach people we can't reach with the print edition. Obviously, the local readers that we have are by far the most loyal users of the site, so it's not, you know, the 50% is certainly not an insignificant amount of the traffic that we have, but we certainly are in a position where we can try a lot of things to reach people we can't reach otherwise.
The comparable number for nytimes.com is about 12 million uniques from Nielsen. And that's our national audience. About 15% of our audience, in addition, is overseas.
And is there a way of tracking what they read and what they don't read? Do you have a sense that it's mostly politics or that they're looking for something else?
Well, I mean, different readers. One of the wonderful things about the web is that different people come in and read us in different ways. And one of the efforts that we've been making is to present the news that we present in a wide variety of ways. So, in addition to having the homepage experience, which most closely resembles the news judgment that you would get if you looked at the printed New York Times, we also now have something called Today's Paper, which lists all the articles in the paper in the order in which they appeared, roughly. So you get some of the serendipity that comes from the way that the New York Times is packaged, but we also have our most popular list. So if you want to know what articles are most being emailed by nytimes.com readers to their friends and use that as a way of forming news, what you want to read, that's there, or how many bloggers are blogging about which of the articles. So we offer a wide variety of different ways to get into the site.
This also gives editors an insight into what people find interesting, doesn't it? That could also be scary if there's an important story, but there doesn't seem to be all that much interest in it. In the past, we've been told that usually meant less coverage. This could mean almost death to those dense economic stories.
Well, no, not really. I mean, we don't edit the paper or our news coverage based on our most popular list, and it does sort of tend towards the quirky. I mean, when we do an article about macaroni and cheese, as we did a couple months ago, it stayed on the most popular list for days. Another article that you didn't see on page one, but that was passed around a lot by our readers online, was about infertility from bicycle seats. So we don't change the way that we edit hard news, but it does give us a good idea of what people are looking at when we do more enterprise or feature articles.
Jim, the Post breaks.
And the worst thing about the web is how much information you have about how people use it. You can really drive yourself crazy if you look too closely at it. You really have to step back and try to spot trends more than getting into the weeds and looking at how something's moving on an hour-by-hour basis.
Absolutely.
But you do break down the most viewed articles by section at the Post, which is a way of suggesting that the macaroni and cheese article is not the same sort of thing as the breaking scandal in, I don't know, I'm going to name a place that's not going to get me in trouble with either political party, the breaking scandal in Kenya, which was a story, actually, today in the New York Times.
Yeah, well, I think there's, you know, the quirky story is almost always going to work, and I think that's what I'm talking about spotting a trend. We know that the offbeat thing works. We certainly know people come to the Washington Post for politics and foreign news and national news, so, I mean, but, you know, there are certain subtopics within there that obviously we realize are hot topics, but, you know, we, again, try not to get too into the hour-by-hour stuff.
And is, I would assume that when people hear that there's something that's going on, maybe they heard a little headline on the news at the top of the hour on their favorite radio station, they will then go to the internet to find out a lot more about it. That means that you have to continually rewrite these stories. How often do you update these stories?
Well, it depends on the story. I mean, something going on, certainly a breaking news event on the Hill will probably update the story, you know, once every 90 minutes for the course of the day. Bigger stories, the London bombing was updated much more frequently than that. I think it's the story obviously drives how often it needs to be updated. But, you know, there's a challenge that even falls before the one you're talking about, which is when that person hears that something is going on and goes to the web, I think the challenge we all have is that we have to be the site they come to in the first place. And I think that's what we really, that's the major difference on the web for us, is that there are, you know, 100 really good, you know, sites within 10 or 12 keystrokes that we're all fighting for attention with. And I think that's in the Washington area. There's a couple of printed publications the Post is competing with, but the Post is pretty dominant locally on the print side. But on the web, you know, we're just another site putting our hand up trying to get people to come to us. Obviously, the brand name helps us a lot, but we have to get people to the site first.
And there's the sort of built-in disadvantage of being a site that's primarily known for print doesn't give you the idea of immediacy in the way that some of the broadcast sites do, particularly cable news. And so we're also battling that.
Does the information that you collect about how many people are reading a certain article, a certain story, get filtered back to the print side?
Yes. You know, we make the most popular, you know, the top 100 URLs we get are accessed by the managers over at the Post, and they look at that, and, you know, we try to make it clear to them that they shouldn't read too much into any one thing, because, you know, a story that gets 5 times the traffic it normally gets could very easily have gotten it because Matt Drudge linked to it from his website, as opposed to it being, you know, an incredible incredible piece of journalism that was far better than anything else in the paper that day. A lot of times it's serendipity.
I know that a lot of people in the newsroom follow our most popular list online, but there's no real organized effort to provide that information to the newsroom, although it's there if they want to see it.
My guests are Rich Meislin, Associate Managing Editor for Internet at the New York Times, and Jim Brady, who's Executive Editor of WashingtonPost.com. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with our discussion of the growing online presence of newspapers with Jim Brady, executive editor of WashingtonPost.com, and Rich Meislin, associate managing editor for Internet at the New York Times. When newspaper membership readership is measured now, are websites figures taken into account, Jim?
They're not taken into account certainly on the official newspaper circulation front, but I think, you know, philosophically as a company, we certainly view them as numbers that need to be taken together. Obviously, the footprint of Washington Post readership, or the number of people reading the Washington Post across the country, has never been higher than it is today because of the website. So, but clearly there's a, you know, the whole business side of it is something we're dealing with as well, which is there's a significant advertising piece to the newspaper that we're trying to make up for on the website.
Because although overall print circulation is down, the traffic on the newspaper websites is up. And I would think that if you combined it all, you could say to advertisers, we actually have more readers than we ever had. That's not the way it's been working, Rich.
Well, it's not, although one of the things that the Times has done in recent months is to combine the advertising sales staffs from online and print in order to try to do joint sales. And to increase the number of people that we have essentially selling in both media. The Times on the web now gets more readers in an average day than the daily newspaper prints. So, we understand how important that audience is to the total audience of the New York Times.
Listeners to this show, during a call-in segment we did about this, said that they read the online version during the week, listeners who read the online version. Some said that they can't imagine it. You just can't read it on the subway. But they may read it during the week, but they like to sit down with the Sunday paper and page through the sections. Is traffic down on the weekends?
Traffic is, in fact, down on the weekends. It's a very large package to go through on the weekend, and also a lot of our readership comes in offices and people are at home on weekends. One of the things that we're doing that was announced a few weeks ago, as far as the subway part of this goes, is we're working with Microsoft on a new product that gives you a more newspaper-like experience on a small tablet device that you can, in fact, take on the subway. And the designer who's been working on it, our design director, Tom Botkin, has taken it on the subway a couple times and gets quite some looks from people as he's reading it there.
You had something to add to that, Jim.
Well, our traffic is also down on weekends, but ironically, in the last year, the biggest percentage gain on any single day has been on Sunday. So we're not, I wish I could tell you exactly what that means. We don't necessarily know, but we certainly are starting to see, and some of it, I imagine, has to do with increased broadband penetration at home. We are starting to see weekend traffic start to be a number that's significant enough that we're considering additional staffing.
Well, I mentioned earlier that the Post is essentially a local newspaper without a wide national daily circulation. On the other hand, it is the local newspaper, the capital of the United States. So when you check out what is being read, do you find that you're being treated as a national newspaper, or do people want to know what's going on locally in Washington?
Well, I think we're both, and I think that's something we addressed last year when we actually went to a homepage setup where if you give us a local zip code, you actually get a different homepage, and if you give us a national zip code, we've much more local news, weather, traffic, Redskins, things like that. We decided, because we'd spent so much time, I think really the entire time the site has been in existence, trying to deal with the schizophrenia of, are we a national site, are we a local site? And we tried to be both for 10 years, and then finally decided that, there's between the huge, national audience that we're growing, but the huge dependence we have on local users, not only for traffic, but for revenue, that we really needed to address them both. So that's why we went to the two homepage philosophy, and it's been pretty successful for us in terms of traffic to the homepage. But we have a lot of stories that, that are huge locally but are utterly meaningless if you live outside the metropolitan area. And we've always had trouble as a site figuring out how to deal with those kind of stories. So this is our solution.
The Times seems to have resolved that problem by thinking of itself as a national newspaper. If anything, locals complain that the Times is more likely to write about something happening in Cleveland than something happening in the Bronx.
Well, the newspaper itself views itself as more of a national newspaper than it did in the past, although it still has a very heavy, metro area staff and presence. One of the things that we're looking at right now are what things we can do to beef up our service to people in the local area.
The decision to introduce Time Select was not met with universal approval, including from some of the Times' own op-ed columnists. What are some of the advantages of creating a subscription-only area on the site?
Well, it was largely an effort to see whether we could expand the revenue streams that are available to us as we make the transition, from print to print plus digital, and who knows what comes beyond. Having a revenue stream that's entirely based on advertising is more dangerous than having one that has more than one source. Being an editorial side person, I can't give you the full logic behind it, but we also packaged it with a group of services that people had said that they had wanted. It wasn't just the columnists, but also open access to the archives and an automated clipping service, excuse me, and a feature that allows you to save pages from the Times and elsewhere on the web. And it's largely been successful, although I grant you that there are a number of people who don't like having to pay for it. On the other hand, we also offered it as a free add-on to people who are home delivery subscribers, and that's been extremely popular.
Well, would it be possible to charge a daily fee for the online newspaper if it was much lower than the print version?
It's not my expertise. Well, the Wall Street Journal does, they've gotten into, I think, the 700,000 or 800,000 range. They have the advantage of being a paper that many people's companies will reimburse them for. I don't know of a general interest newspaper that is successfully charging for access at the moment.
Has the Time Select approach been successful?
It's hard to figure out what to compare it to, but it's been successful.
If 20 people signed up.
Well, a lot of people have signed up in the many hundreds of thousands.
Jim, has the Post ever considered making some areas accessible only by subscription?
We've considered it in the past. Right now, we're sticking with the model of just trying to build our audience and monetizing that through advertising. And Rich is right that that's a risky proposition in a lot of ways. You know, you're sort of a slave to how the ad market goes. But at this point, we just decided to, there's so many good news sites out there, and we're just afraid, if you put a paywall up for certain content, you might drive people away from that. We had a significant drop off in traffic when we put up pre-registration a couple of years ago, and we weren't even asking for really anything other than a couple of pieces of data. So, based on that experience, we've just decided to stick with this strategy.
So, should I assume that the sites aren't really self-sufficient economically yet?
It depends on how you gauge self-sufficient. We have the benefit of a newsroom of 1,200 people.
So there's a synergy factor.
If we included the entire cost of supporting the newsroom, we would not be self-sufficient. The digital operation itself is, in fact, self-sufficient.
Yeah, we're in the same position. Obviously, we are self-sufficient as a standalone unit, but we don't have to support a newsroom.
My guests are Jim Brady, who is executive editor of WashingtonPost.com, and Rich Meislin, associate managing editor for Internet at The New York Times. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Rich, the Times' website underwent some pretty drastic changes in April. Was there a need to refashion the site? What was wrong with the old one?
Well, people liked it a lot. It certainly was very popular. We were looking for a number of different things in the redesign. We wanted to give ourselves a little more flexibility in trying to portray the kind of news judgment that you can portray on the front page of the printed newspaper. We were trying to make it clearer to people what lies underneath our homepage because there is so much there, and it's hard drawing attention to the various parts of the site. And so we were looking for ways that we could highlight more of the site. We wanted to give more prominence to the work that we're doing in video, and so we added a video feature on the homepage. We tried to clean up some of the navigation because it had gotten very long and cluttered. We hadn't redesigned in 5 years. And then one of the other things that was important for us to take into account is how much of our traffic now comes via the search engines like Google and Yahoo. And we wanted to make it clear to people who come in at a point in the site lower than the homepage that there were all these other interesting things to look at when you're on the New York Times site. So we restructured the navigation below the homepage to give people a much quicker way of getting around and to remind new users that there are other things than the article that they came in specifically looking for.
But you've also taken some sections that used to be in print, like the stock prices, and just moved them online.
Yes, that was a combined editorial and business decision. The fact is, for the vast majority of our readers, having stock information the next morning is late. So we're still printing it in the Sunday papers for people who want to follow it in print. But as far as the daily newspaper, that has moved online.
And Jim, WashingtonPost.com underwent a big change last year, but then recently you've changed the type font again.
On the site?
Yeah, haven't you?
No, I don't think so.
But what about the change that you did last year? Was that for the same reasons that Rich has been discussing?
Well, we've, you know, I got into this job last January, and, you know, the changes we've made largely on the site in the last year have been trying to, you know, change how people perceive journalism on the web, and that, you know, in the printed world, the publication of the article is sort of the last act, the last part of the process, and on the web, we're trying to make it the first act, which is, once the reporter files a story for the web and puts it on, they're willing to come on and answer questions. We make it easy for readers to send them email to get into some kind of dialogue. We allow very easy access to people to go directly to blogs that are talking about Post content, often not in an extremely positive light, but nonetheless to extend that conversation and turn, you know, the site into more of a kind of universal coffee shop where people can talk about the issues of the day. So most of the changes we made have not been so much on the design side as much as on the philosophical side.
And have these added blogs and daily online chats developed a large following?
Yeah. I mean, the blogs are among the most popular things we have on the site. We've been able to build real communities around some of our blogs, like Joel Achenbach's humor blog and Mark Fisher's local blog. And, you know, we're doing about 80, 90 hours a week of live online programming now. And, you know, our uniques are way up in the last year, so we certainly feel pretty comfortable that we're reaching an expanded audience based on that. But, you know, it's a long battle. I mean, this is, you know, every 2 months on the web, there's a new hot thing that you have to make a pretty quick decision whether to embrace as the next big thing or ignore as the latest fad. So I think that's what, you know, we're all struggling with on a day-to-day basis. But we're pretty comfortable with the strategy we've undertaken, which is breaking down the walls between, you know, the journalists and the readers.
You also connect political articles with the blogs that cover the same subject. But do the reporters like participating in these chats? Because this means a lot more of their time is being devoted to things that they didn't have to think about in the past.
You know, we're up about, you know, the number of people from the newsroom who are interested in doing live discussions on the site has probably doubled in the last 2 years. So I think people find them really engaging, and they, you know, being able to get in this dialogue with readers, and they'll often walk out of those live discussions with good story ideas. You know, we're starting to use some of the exchanges that happen in those in the paper. So I think most reporters find them to be kind of a nice way to engage with their audience.
But the newspaper, the print newspaper, is edited. The reporter might write something and then find it changed a bit in the process of going into print. Do you do that here as well?
No, live online is pretty much an off-the-cuff thing. But
you've got to trust your reporters.
Yeah, you're touching on an issue, which is certainly an issue I think we're all struggling with a little bit as we go forward, which is the unedited content, which is not just the live onlines, but it's, you know, we edit blogs before they go live in most cases, but it does, you know, but there are television appearances, there are radio appearances. You know, reporters, you know, I think are struggling with the challenge of how do you go on all these different media, you know, types and discuss the same article and try to stay true to the objectivity that you have to take into that story. Obviously, if you're a columnist, you don't have those limitations. But, and I think this is something we work with the paper a lot on, is the voice of reporters in places where they're not editable.
But there's a certain democratizing aspect to this. When I read letters to the editor in a newspaper, I know that they've been chosen to make a point, often to support the newspaper's position, and then a couple of opposing voices are thrown in. But I have no idea whether 80% of the mail has been in opposition to the newspaper's position on something. Here, I pretty much see everything that's come in, don't I?
Well, what we're doing on our blogs is we're doing some light moderation, and as Jim said, we're doing some light editing on our blogs. But you see the vast majority of the, and I mean the vast majority of the comments that come in on the various things that are being written. You know, we're also increasingly using here and there on the site the ability to add comments to articles, and you'll be seeing more of that as the months go by.
The Washington Post and Newsweek are owned by the same parent company, so are the sites closely linked, Jim?
I mean, Newsweek editorial is run out of New York. Obviously, we're run out here in Arlington, Virginia, but I'm in constant touch with Newsweek, and we trade links a fair amount and are often involved in the same deals when companies come in to pitch things. We're usually, often, in fact, involved in the same negotiations. So we don't have a day-to-day relationship, but we have a good relationship on a sort of more weekly basis.
You're also linked to Slate.
Correct. We have exactly. Slate and Budget Travel are also run by Washington Post, Newsweek Interactive. So they all have different editorial staffs and a central sort of business business services, so HR and things like that are all right now in the same place.
And do you find that readers are using these links a lot?
Yeah, I think that we have links on a lot of our article pages to Slate. Slate links to us on a lot of their article pages, and we've certainly seen a nice uptick for both of us in tying those audiences together.
Rich, does the Times link to its other newspaper sites like the International Herald Tribune and the Boston Globe?
We do some linking to the International Herald Tribune, less to the Boston Globe. The cooperation level on some things, we did a joint blog with the IHT on Davos, for example, and we're going to be doing some stuff with them on the World Cup is something that we're starting to develop.
And this actually seems to me to be an incredible thing for news junkies, because they're able to keep up with what's going on, but also connect to all the different sources on the internet. My fear is that if I ever got caught up in this, I'm never going to go to work.
Well, that's quite possible. There is an endless amount of material that you can get. We're starting a new service called My Times, where you're going to be able to personalize your web experience, not just using New York Times material, but bringing in other sources from the web that you like. So that will at least allow you to put it in one concentrated place. The difference between it and other services like that is that we will have New York Times reporters recommending places on the web that you might find interesting depending on their and your areas of interest. That should be coming out quite soon.
And Jim, you probably have some devious plans in store for us as well.
I wouldn't call them devious, but no, we're still working on, you know, as Rich said, the Times is, we're working on comments on articles as well, and, you know, trying to, you know, take the conversation that much closer. We're looking to do things that will allow readers to have their own place on our site where they can aggregate kind of things that they've done and areas of the site that they like, and even other readers that they enjoy interacting with, and you know, sort of build communities around a lot of the areas on the site. So we have a lot of things, just obviously many of them are based on community and interactivity, and we'll keep pushing that.
Well, before we go, I wonder if you're willing to make a prediction on whether there is some time in the foreseeable future when some newspapers, maybe not yours, will eliminate the print version altogether and just simply go on the web.
Oh, I'm sure some will. I'm not on the bandwagon that newspapers are dead, will be dead anytime in the near future. But I'm sure there are certainly some places that will decide that, you know, losing all the costs associated with printing and distributing the paper is worth it. But I don't think it's going to happen here for some time.
I tend to agree.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. We've been talking with Jim Brady, executive editor of WashingtonPost.com, and Rich Meislin, associate managing editor for Internet at the New York Times.
Great. Thanks very much.